It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, Tarncast. It's the Tarncast, Tarncast. This is the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, the Tarncast.
Hello, this is Tom Hargis for the Tarncast, and my guest this week is Todd Robert Anderson.
Hi, I'm Todd Robert Anderson.
Yeah, that's what I said. But now, you know what? I just got to do this because I'm just going to blow this right, you know, wide open here.
What are you doing?
Because for those who maybe have been listening to the Tarncast, you know, the subscribers, they might have figured out by now that. Well, you're the only guest ever.
I'm not 100% sure what you're talking about. I mean, I just go, I have representation. My representation says these people want you to be a guest on their podcast. I've done many different podcasts. Uh-huh. I think this is the first time I've ever been on your show.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's ironically the Tarncast, which apparently there's a lot of them out there.
I have been on other podcasts called the Tarncast, but I know between you and them.
Yeah,
you need to discuss that with them.
Okay.
I mean, my people just send me somewhere. They say this is going to be good for your, you know, for doing your stuff, for promoting your stuff. So I go, you know,
okay.
And I got
all right, a lot of stuff
to promote. I'm an entertainer.
Okay. Well, then I guess, you know, my first question, which might not make any sense to you at all.
Uh-huh.
Considering the world that we're inhabiting, is this by far the most narcissistic thing you've ever done?
Well, I'm not. That's a strange question, given that I don't know how being a guest on your podcast would be narcissistic.
Sure.
But hypothetically speaking. If, because there seems to be some confusion about the Tarncast name, but if there was a podcast called the Tarncast,
right, where
and
somebody was
I designed it so that I would always be the guest,
right,
and there would always be a different host asking me questions, I would say that's both narcissistic and intensely lazy. Because if it were, you know, quote unquote, my show, and I was asking people to come to my show,
right,
preparing questions and an interview that I would simply have to sit there and respond to, I think that, I mean, it's narcissistic and lazy.
Well, no,
more pointedly.
But I'm not really saying that as a negative, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of genius, really. Because I think, well, you know, I thought about the concept and I thought, well, you know, what is the reasoning behind the concept? And maybe it's to set some sort of record for having been the guest on the most number of podcasts.
Yeah.
And the only way to really achieve that is to set it up where you're always going to be the guest.
So
is this really going to just be like a Guinness Book of World Records thing?
I mean, I want to reiterate that I am speaking hypothetically because this is not my podcast.
Right.
This is your podcast.
Which is very strange, too, because I'm not an actor. I'm not even sure what I am these days, right? But I'm barely involved in entertainment these days.
Well, my people said that you're a professional photographer. Cinematographer.
Yeah.
And then you had a podcast, and I just assumed it would be related to photography or something. Which I thought was strange to have me on as a guest because I know precious little about photography.
And the interesting thing is that what we're going to be talking about today probably has nothing to do with entertainment or photography or anything.
That's really interesting. It's odd that you chose to host a podcast.
So
I think a lot of people who aren't actors have podcasts now. I mean, there are lots of different podcasts. I mean, I think people gravitate naturally towards the ones with celebrity entertainers.
Yeah, right.
You know, the most successful podcast going is probably Marc Maron's,
right? Yeah.
But there's a lot of other ones. There's I listen to a lot of podcasts because I'm in my car a lot.
See, I got to do that more. I'm starting to get clued in on this whole podcast thing, even though apparently I run one.
Well, well, you're just like Marc Maron. He doesn't listen to any other podcast but his own.
Okay.
And another thing, you know, hypothetically, if I was going to do a kind of narcissistic feeling podcast like you're suggesting this is, which it isn't, but maybe what that would be is not so much narcissistic thing, but maybe it's a satirical in nature, sort of making fun of the narcissism of podcasts in general.
I see. Okay.
But there are a lot of really cool ones that actually aren't narcissistic at all.
So this could be clever.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. That
the jury's out.
Hypothetically, if I did that, that would be up to
very clever.
Maybe.
So I have been listening to past Toncasts.
Other Toncasts other than your own
that you have been on.
Oh yeah, that's weird. I don't know. Have the numbers on how many I've guested on.
And there's I've been noticing some things that have come up. First of all, the Blizzard of 78.
The Blizzard, people ask me about that a lot.
The Blizzard of 78 has come up twice now on these shows that you've been on. And I'm just wondering because first of all, where are you from again?
Massachusetts.
I grew up in Indiana.
Oh, okay.
And so I experienced the Blizzard of 78 as well. I remember it so well. But the number of times that comes up in my life. Not very often. And it came up twice for you.
Yeah.
In two separate podcasts.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And I'm wondering, what was it about the Blizzard of 78? What happened? It's obviously a huge event in your life because do you think about it a lot?
Yeah, no. It's one of those things when you go on these press junkets that I do, where I'm getting interviewed, is they have talking points, and hosts will hear other stories they've heard that they like and they want to go over in the show. I think the Blizzard of 78, if I recall, the question had something to do with when was the first time I realized I was very special.
And you attached that to the Blizzard of 78 and your father, right?
Right. And then the same question came up again in another. So just because I'd gone to that story and it seemed like a good example as to why I was very special, I used it again.
That's good. You got a go-to story on why you're special.
Yeah. I mean, there are really a lot, but that one is, I think the most powerful.
And it was because your father built you a fortress or whatever.
A maze. In the deep snow.
Yeah.
Yeah. For my birthday. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was sort of like how you started to get into acting in a way, right? Is that when you started to think about acting?
When I was stuck in the snow maze? Yeah. Because at one point I got lost in the maze and I was pretty terrified. Hmm. And I had to find a happy place and I thought about television. In my happy place, and then I thought,
is that true? Really?
This everything I'm saying is absolutely true. I thought I was dying.
See, I want that to be true.
I thought I was dying in the maze, and I thought about TV and how nice it would be to be on television. Well, yeah.
That was something. I remember the Blizzard of 78 very well.
I'll bet Jack Nicholson's character, when he was dying in his snow maze at the end of The Shining, same thought.
Gilligan,
if I get out of this, I'm going to be an actor.
Oh, yeah. Or I thought maybe he was thinking about Gilligan's Island.
Well, maybe that's what started it. That's all I'm saying. I mean, it was like, as he was slowly freezing to death, he thought of Gilligan's Island, because wouldn't that be warm and nice?
He did have a kind of smile on his face a frozen smile on his face.
That's a solid point. So clearly, Jack, the character Jack, portrayed by Jack Nicholson in The Shining, was thinking of Gilligan's Island and then becoming an actor as he froze to death.
Yeah. And so how are things lately? This is a very general question.
How are things in general?
Yeah. How's the state of Todd Anderson?
Well, there's good and there's bad, and I take the good.
All right. Wait, which one do you want to go for right now? And take them both in there you have, right?
Yeah,
right,
the facts of life. Yeah. You tell me, you're the inner, I'll tell you about the good or the bad. I'm not a secretive person. I have nothing to hide.
Right, right.
So you can, do you want to hear the good or the bad?
Well, you know, let's start out with the good. What's good right now?
You know, my family's good. Uh-huh. My wife is a school teacher. Yeah. And she's healthy, and she's enjoying her job, and mm-hmm. my son is in kindergarten.
How old is he now?
6.
So, okay, it's, you do kindergarten when you're 6, is that? Because I have a 13-month-old son uh-huh. right now, and so all this is still relatively new to me.
It's 5 or 6. It depends on
when they're born.
When they're born. And, okay. and the truth is my son is on his second year of kindergarten, because he was actually born 2 months early. His due date would have prevented him from going into kindergarten last year.
Mm-hmm.
But because he was born early, it was sort of a, you know, we were discussing keeping him in daycare for another year, sending him to kindergarten. But because the kindergarten's at my wife's school, we figured it'd be okay. We could work with him if he struggled.
See, I think that's good. I think you got to do it later. You know, I remember I went to kindergarten. Well, I went to nursery school, right? Or mm-hmm. I guess they call it preschool now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but back then it was nursery school, and I was a nursery school dropout.
Oh.
Yeah, I was not prepared to go to nursery school. I think it was four. I must have been 4.
Were you lashing out? Did you start like a nursery school gang or something? Were you bringing weapons to school?
I think I was just so unhappy about going to school every day that my mom eventually said, you know what, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do this to the, and so well, they let me skip it.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to kindergarten and then I was okay. But I think it's like, yeah, you got to give kids like another.
Well, you got to go with what yeah. the kid is naturally inclined to do. It wasn't going somewhere away from the parents that he had a problem with. It actually was just a developmental struggle with learning.
Mm.
He just wasn't ready to write. He did the motor functions. It's like simple things that you don't yeah. think about as an adult because you write all the time and you read all the time.
Sure.
Well, I you know, if you're mildly intelligent, you do these things.
I'm watching this happen right now with my own son, you know, and he's figuring out. I mean, he's just about ready to walk, right?
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
and it's the most fascinating thing to watch, to develop, you know, from you were just basically a fetus on the outside, you know, 12 months ago. And now you're like telling jokes practically,
right?
You know, I
right.
mean,
that's the same thing with my son with at this level, because especially comparing the 2 years of last year and this year,
yeah.
now he's just taken to reading, you know, and it's not a chore; it's something he wants to do, mm-hmm. and that's the difference. Actually, my brother, who he did the same thing when he was a kid,
yeah,
for slightly different reasons, because he, you know, he was super smart. So he was in, you know, first grade early,
mm-hmm.
But he was miserable socially. So my mom actually held him back, even though the academics of it were sort of boring for him with kids more
right
in his developmental stage socially.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, went from being a struggling kid to being happy.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true with my son, too, is, you know, even though it's different reasons,
yeah.
you know, he just wasn't ready both physically and developmentally
yeah. Yeah.
To do the school stuff. He was always good at math, but it yeah. was more writing and reading.
And he loves books.
Yes.
See, Jack loves books. I mean, he finds them very tasty.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. He eats them.
Colby. I mean, he likes to look at them, but then eventually he'll just have a big chunk of book in his mouth and he'll be chewing it, you know, so.
Colby was never, you know, we're lucky in that way. He wasn't the kind of kid who would eat sand. You know, he never jammed stuff in yeah. his mouth. That wasn't a sense that he felt.
Yeah.
It was just like he'd try different foods, which is weird because,
yeah.
you know, a lot of kids who jam sand in their mouth will also only eat macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, right.
It's like, but it's like sand and macaroni and cheese.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then he was never like eating wood or anything.
Yeah.
But he'll like, yeah, well. He has a wide berth of culinary tastes,
yeah,
I guess you'd say.
I don't think Jack has a very discriminating palate at this point. I mean, he'll eat his crib. you know, he chews on books. He'll find something on the floor and put it in his mouth. You know, but luckily he'll also take it out of his mouth and give it to us. Oops, I just hit the microphone there.
That's all right. Well, I'm sure your producers will fix that.
Yeah, sure. We'll edit that out.
Yeah.
It's just very fascinating to watch the whole development. So how's this changed for you when Colby was born in terms of your career?
Mm-hmm.
How did that change things? Did it change it at all? Did it change your perspective? Did it? I mean, how?
Well, being sort of a blue collar actor, you know, an old school.
That's a good way of looking of describing your career.
Yeah, I'm a blue collar guy. Dabney Coleman called me a bit player, which was condescending and rude. But that's essentially, you know, I make my living in 30-second commercials and small guest star roles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm blue collar, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. That's my career.
And then how did that, I mean, did it change it at all when you had, cause I mean, look, this is just something I've been dealing with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole, I mean, you can't help it, right? You know, you have a child,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly you start reevaluating everything.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
maybe you don't. Maybe you just go on. Maybe that's just me.
I think a lot of people reevaluate stuff. I think a lot of people turn to the bottle. I reevaluated stuff, and when I did all the math, I had to turn to the bottle.
There was no choice, right?
There was no choice. Right. It didn't actually change my career, I don't think. I mean, as far as the direction it's gone or not, it's, you know, I'm pretty consistent, mm-hmm. in that I have long spells where I don't work and long spells where I do work.
Right.
The only thing that having a kid made me aware of is just how precious little money I made.
Yeah.
When it was just me and even when it was just me and my wife,
yeah.
in an apartment, then every time things were good, I was like, this is great. I can live like this forever. I can mm-hmm. have this career forever and be all right with it.
Yep.
But then once we had a baby and a mortgage, then I started realizing I don't make enough money on a regular basis
mm-hmm.
to feel comfortable. So if it changed anything as far as my career is concerned, it has made me much more aware of, which I guess doesn't have to do with my career, but it does because it's how I make money, but it's made me much more aware of how much money I make, how to budget my money,
mm-hmm.
And the terror of running out of money. Which
right, because it's hard. You can't just like suddenly I'm going to generate more money, you know, in this line of work, right?
No,
it's like you're waiting for the next, you know, casting call, right?
And right.
Hopefully get the job. And
I work, you know, essentially, I mean, commercials, it's all scale. I have a slightly, you know, higher quote for certain kinds of theatrical work. But if it's a scrapper paycheck, they're just going to say, this is what we're going to pay. And you can come in or not.
That is just the scariest thing. I've never, you know, as a cinematographer, I've always felt like there's been somewhat of a I understand what actors go through,
mm-hmm.
but it's just worse with actors because it's not based on what you've done in the past. Somewhat it might be, you know, but to a degree, it's really about, do they like your face? Do they like the way that they, you know, you show up? Do you look the part? Do you, you know, can I see you in the, you know, and so you might get turned down. And it has nothing to do with like experience or anything. At least as a cinematographer, you can make a reel, and it's like, I can see that he can light. He knows how to move a camera. He can compose. Yeah,
there's no.
I like the way that looks.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's true. Although, I mean, there is.
Although it's the same
with acting, there is certainly, you know, at least seasoned professionals. And when I say that, I mean, you know, casting directors have been around, and producers have been around, and directors have been around. I'm hesitant to say executives have been around, but I'm sure there's some who see talent and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people who are, you know, the suits, as they call them, are, you know, business school graduates as opposed to creative people,
mm-hmm.
business school graduates who love movies or whatever. But I think that if you're if you're good at your job, you can assess an actor properly. It doesn't necessarily mean that, because I mean, you know, and this could be just people being polite, but I can't tell you how many times I've had auditions and people have gushed at me, "You're really such a good actor," and then then I walk out and I know as soon as I hear that,
yeah,
the verbal tip, and I'm not saying it's not genuine. I think if they don't like you, they'll just go, "Okay, thanks a lot."
Right.
Thanks
sure.
a lot. It
right.
was great meeting you. And
right.
then you're
it's
like,
better
wow,
to say nothing.
Yeah. They thought I sucked or they were indifferent or whatever. Yeah. But if someone says, you know, if they really feel compelled to tell me how great I was, and then I know, well, they do like me, but I'm not getting this job.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's when you're in the room and they like actually, you know, put you through a ringer with everybody, you know,
yeah.
and
yeah.
I mean, and even when you're not like you don't go in and nail it. If they like your look enough, they'll sit there and work with you
yeah.
until they get to a place where they think you get what they're
right,
going
right,
for.
Right.
And then you know you've got the job. But then there's most of these jobs, you get it the second you walk through the door.
Yeah, no, that yeah, right. It's a snap decision, isn't it?
Yeah, they're like, "This is the guy."
I mean, being on the
we'll
other end
work.
Of that, you know, it's like you just yeah, you know, being on the in casting sessions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, "Whoa, yeah, you know, that person is really, you know." But although I'm always looking, whenever I'm in one of these casting sessions, I'm always looking for an actor who comes in and surprises me. As far as like, you know, I might have a notion of what this character should be like, and then an actor does a read that is totally different than what I thought. But better and unexpected.
That's an awesome way to approach casting. I don't think that, I mean, I agree. I mean, me and casting stuff, I actually don't look at, you know, when I've done, you know, plays and stuff and actually, you know, been a producer or a director or whatever, I don't look at the looks as much. And more, I'm looking at the spirit of the character. So the look isn't... I mean, obviously, you know, if for the reasons of the play, the person's handsome, then they have to be handsome on some level,
mm-hmm.
you know, or if they're, you know, whatever.
Right, right.
Sure. There's certain realm of the look, but I'm not as stringent, I think, as a lot of people are. But mm-hmm. I also think that so much of television, you go in and you're not... auditioning for the director, you're auditioning for the producers.
Oh,
okay. And a
it.
Lot of the times okay. the producer is also the writer, and writer, and especially writer producers, can be pretty precious with both their words and their characters.
I see,
and they
right,
have a
right.
very specific idea of what
right.
the person looks like. So then they have two or three people who look like that.
Yeah.
And then they become extra precious about the person being exactly what they envision.
Yeah.
It's not it's not as collaborative as what it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, probably. I mean, well, the fact that the cinematographer has like some kind of you know, say into the casting.
Right,
you
right.
You know, obviously, clearly, I'm not involved in,
yeah.
in projects that are...
But it's a very interesting point. I mean, I actually haven't thought about this in a long time. But that's a very interesting point in that...
What is?
If you're in control of everything, if you're a producer or a director or
yeah.
a director-producer, and especially if it's something you've written,
yeah.
You can be very... I mean, I think the ego and lots of other elements make you... very specific
yeah.
and control happy about the whole thing. But if you're more open-minded and you say, "Well, this is what I wrote, but let's see what people bring to it," you know, and you're not, I mean, like I had an audition the other day and it, you know, the producer wasn't even in the room. It was a casting director just, you know, taping it for the producer. And, you know, I'll work with anybody, however they want to work. I'll figure it out. I'm good like that. But she, you know, it was very precious about the words. And I won't memorize stuff by rote
yeah.
For an audition. I'm, you know, I can't. That to once I start memorizing stuff and get that, you know, attached to it, then get when I don't get the job, it's way more horrible than if I'm less attached.
Or I did all this work.
Right. And
memorizing these
And I just want to make it about like showing that I understand the character. And it's not like I'm creating monologues, but I might, you know, flip-flop words and not say it exactly as it's written.
Right, right.
You know, and I'm going on, you know, and it really depends on the show, but also, you know, this particular one, it was a, you know, it's a kid's show, so it's a high energy show.
Yeah.
You know, and so they want the character out and they want the lines to come really fast.
Yeah.
And I get that, and they want it big. So it's hard to glance at your sides to find your place.
Right, you just gotta know.
You know,
right,
as opposed to a drama where you can kind of look at it or something that's more pacing, understated. Right, sure. It's like, wah, 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 wah. So, and she's like, well, some of the words were, you know, some of the lines you were saying other things. And I was like, I imagine so. And she's like, well, we want to get the lines right. And I said, okay, I'll do my best. And then I did this because she liked the audition.
Yeah.
But her only problem was, is, you know, I jumbled some of the words and I said, okay. And then the next one I was doing on book. And she's like, well, now you're kind of in and out on your performance. And I was like, that's because I'm reading. And this kind of audition, there's no room for glancing at your
paper. Because the words are so precious for this children's show.
Well, I mean, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, obviously, she was working for somebody who, you know, and I'm not saying that I was saying it better. That's not. I was just
trying to. But this is an audition, though.
Right, right.
I mean, which is interesting. I mean, that just sounds to me like somebody who's just complete control freak, really. Because I mean,
well, I don't think it was her. I think it was the person she was working for, and she was just trying to get somebody
in that.
But she was also, I mean, she was doing me a service by giving me multiple takes to get it just the way the producer would like it.
Because
the producer probably, because a lot of producers do when you go in. And I know a few personally who have told me that one of their biggest pet peeves is actors coming in and improvising.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's a difference between improvising
and just sort of making the words your own, right? I mean,
a little bit.
I mean, improv is like you don't know what the words are going to be.
Right. You know, so. But I think when people say improv, when they say make it your own, because make it your own, certainly in the commercial world, like, is code for improvisation because they can't legally, because of the Screen Actors Guild, ask you to improvise. So they'll say, just make it your own. And that means make up your own lines.
I think, you know, basically you're looking to work with people like Woody Allen, apparently. Because I just saw, did you see this the documentary on him?
No.
Yeah, there was just recently this documentary on him, and I haven't actually seen a Woody Allen film in quite a while, but the way that he works, apparently, is and he tells his actors, you can follow the words or don't if you want, you know, and he doesn't really, he barely gives direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's you know, and I can see how that could be really terrifying to an actor or very, very liberating.
To me, it's liberating if... I do memorize my lines by rote if it's a written script and I get the job. And with auditions, not so much. So in working, I'm not particularly fond of showing up on a set and having people basically say, yeah, we don't really know what to do with this, so do whatever. Then it's like, but I don't know how it plugs into the story then and what you want. Then you're just going to have a scene that doesn't make sense. So if someone says, you know, make the lines your own or do whatever you want.
What's most your job? Of the time,
yeah.
You want me to do your job?
Right. Most of the time, whatever character, you know, I'm doing, the cadence of the character or whatever works better if I change words around. But at the same time, a lot of writers are very precious, and they've picked their, you know, they've written each line so distinctly according to the character that if you come in and mix it up, make it your own, then it's no longer their character.
Right, right.
And I can understand that. But on an audition level, you know, I think on a certain level, you have to have faith that an actor can memorize something ultimately.
Right. I mean, it's not a memorization test, is it?
Yeah. You know, in that case, it kind of felt like, I didn't memorize it. But if you had said, you know, don't bother coming in unless you have this memorized by heart.
Like they're grading you, you know, and then they say, oh, but you know what? I'm sorry. You don't get it because you have a -3. Yeah. Where the the other actors,
everybody else
they had a minus two or minus one.
Right.
You know,
right.
So that's...
It's like if you forgot, you know, most people don't even use headshots anymore, at least not commercially. They do still theatrically to a degree. Mm-hmm. But so much is electronic now. But it's like, you know, when you're responsible for handing over your photograph and resume,
yeah.
if you forgot it, you know, they're like, they're not going to go, oh, that, I loved him. He was so good. He's perfect for this role. But you know what? He didn't bring his headshot and resume. It's not professional. It's not professional. So we're not going to hire him.
Yeah.
And that,
yeah.
that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And you know, there's, I find people are more surprised by my professionalism than they expect it.
They,
you know, showing up on time, having my lines memorized, you know, not... I mean, there are, you know, actors who
people
are,
think that you're gonna... They think otherwise? People don't know you? Or are you saying people don't know
you? No, I think in general, actors, even when they're hired, walk on a set not necessarily knowing their lines by heart.
Okay, not
prepared. Which isn't necessarily in the film business isn't necessarily a bad thing, given that they change it. And if you have something memorized by rote,
I don't know.
It becomes more difficult to make the adjustments.
I think that's a bad thing. I don't know. I think you got to show up at least knowing where you're going.
Well,
you
know, I think they know. I think a lot of people know where they're going,
yeah.
but they don't know the thing by heart.
Because there's nothing worse than, like, you know, wasting minutes or hours because, you know, an actor is completely not prepared. You know, they come on and it's like, okay, take after take after take. It doesn't matter so much anymore because everything is digital. Very few things are shot on film.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but it's like, man, I just remember, you know, the indie films that I've worked on, 35 millimeter or something. It's like, and they the actor has no clue of what they're supposed to say.
Right.
It's like, no, just keep on going. Just keep on going. I'll get it.
I'll get it. Yeah. But I mean, that's
classic. You got to know it before you can forget it, right?
Exactly. But that's classic. And I mean, it's like, I'm always amazed by, you know, series regulars who, you know, they're working all day.
Yeah.
And, you know, in that case, it's a little different because it's fly by the seat of their pants. You're constantly working on a new script. So committing it to memory is something you do the night before or the morning of.
I don't know
so
how you guys do it.
So I can understand it a little bit more.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I often think about it and it's like, well, you know, in my own... decisions and, you know, what I did as a career. Not that being an actor would ever have been a decision for me because I'm not the actor type. I'm just, I've never been that. I've never wanted that. I've never wanted to really be in front of people, you know. Definitely more of the behind the scenes kind of person. But I often think, wow, what a great thing that must be. You know, just to, if you're a working actor, if you're successful at it in any way, to be able to just show up, you know, and be prepared, you know, and then you just do your job and then you go home. I love that. You know, and always on set, I'm always jealous of actors because they're treated well. You know,
not really my kind of actor, but sure.
Well,
important actors get treated well.
Yeah, or, you know, in general,
I have been treated well, but it depends on the job.
Well, you know, they're generally more treated better than the crew.
Certainly.
So even the, you know, not famous actors, you know,
if by that you mean they get like a honey wagon or like,
you know, it's a pretty nice deal when it's like, okay, your call is at this time because this is when we're going to need you. It's not at, you know, when you're on crew,
you're there 2 hours before the actors.
You're there first thing, you know, in the morning before anyone, and then you're there before any, you know,
yeah, after everyone leaves. Gone. Yeah,
you're still
true.
You're there. You got these really crazy long days where I'm just so fantasized, you know, where it's like, okay, well, Todd's done. Does he have anything more? No, it's like 3 in the afternoon. Okay, well, we're going to call it a day for you. You're looking ahead, it's like, oh, I got like 8 more hours.
I understand that.
I just have to say that just has always been. But
no,
that's
awesome. I mean, it also depends on the level of the actor. Because, I mean, I think commercial actors, you know, a lot of times you're there. The crew has maybe 2 hours more of work than you do, really. Because I usually will see the crew call and it's 6:30 and my call is 7. Mm-hmm. You know, so I usually show up a half hour early to work because mm-hmm. I always make sure I have plenty of time to get there, so I'm not late.
Right.
So I'm not hanging up the crew because I respect that everybody's working here and I'm not, you know, special. I have a job to do.
Yeah.
So I usually wind up showing up around the same time as the crew on commercials, and they keep you till the bitter end. And maybe the crew has another hour or 2 hours of work after I leave just because they're done shooting. But when they need the actor there, you know, until they wrap the cameras, I'm there the whole time.
No, that's true. In the commercial world, it's different unless you're a principal player on a series or something where you're in, you know, 95% of the scenes or something.
Right.
I guess it's the same way as well. But I guess, you know, in more of the indie feature world, which is the one that I'm more familiar with, I guess, is, you know, you've got so many different actors.
Right.
And everybody's, you know, so unless it's the principal actor, the principal role, the lead, you know, everybody else is like they show up and then. It just always seemed really nice to me.
Yeah, I hear you. The other side of it is that a lot of those actors who are going home early had small parts, and they had a minimal amount of hours because they had a minimal amount to do, which amounts to a minimal amount of screen time. So they're not making as much money as somebody who's there all day and is a lead. And they're also maybe when they're wrapped that day, they go home and wonder, well, I wonder when's the next time I get to go and spend three hours on set. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. And I think there winds up being a lot of animosity between crew people and actors for those very reasons. And actors can be total douchebags and think they're special. And a lot of, you know, stars make these demands and there's always a reason, you know, you make these crazy contractual demands to make sure that they're paying attention to your contract.
Right, right. It's the, and I all, heard about the, that.
The M&M thing. Do, yeah. Right, to make yeah, sure. Cause if yeah. you don't get the M&Ms, then that means they're not reading the contract and the things that are important might be getting you.
Exactly. That might get you killed on stage.
Right, right. Exactly. So you know, there's that, but you know, I also think there's a certain level of entitlement with lead players. Certainly, people who started young. Like, I hear a lot of interviews with Bryan Cranston, who is probably one of the greatest living American actors right now. I would say. I don't know if you watch Breaking Bad.
No, I'm just so horrible at. I'm a really bad consumer of TV.
Well, that shame on you, because television is the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And TV and movies are currently the only thing that this country produces. So it's the only source of actual income this country has. So you should be at home watching TV all the time.
I know.
It's the only way to improve our situation.
You know what? It's interesting. I've kind of actually analyzed that a little bit on why my disinterest. You know, when this is supposedly the career that I've chosen, why am I so disinterested in like watching the thing that everybody's watching?
Well,
that I admit are good, but there's a weird thing that I just don't use TV in that way anymore. I don't know. It's almost like work to me.
Maybe that's part of it.
You know?
I mean, it's like a busman's holiday. You get done working and making pictures, but then you don't want to turn on the pictures.
But you know, yeah. Although I'm not busy enough to have that excuse,
right.
So I think there's a deeper reason, and I'm not really sure what it is yet. You know, other than. You know, it's easy for me to turn on something like that show How It's Made.
That's one of the podcasts. Before we got off track, but you were asking me what other podcasts I listen to that aren't so narcissistic.
Yeah.
And there's one associated with that same website called, I think it's called Stuff You Should Know.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Which is a podcast, which I listen to. And another one is a British one called The Naked Scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, obviously a science podcast.
And so for me to, like, watch those kinds of programs are, like, semi-informational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you feel like you learned something from it, you know? But at the same time, it's like candy, you know, you just have it and then it's gone.
And
there's no commitment to it.
It's funny. I don't have that with TV because I like to just to finish my point before about Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad. Just really fast, you know, about the actor thing. I mean, it sort of depends on the actors you're working with, and if you're not, you know, judgmental as a crew member, you might meet someone who's just like you, even though you have different jobs. Bryan Cranston, you know, as successful as he is, says, "Well, it's just lucky. I got lucky. I got lucky here, and I got lucky here."
Right.
And some people don't get those other things of luck.
Yeah.
Like, say, me, and I'm sort of...
Or say me.
I'm sort of... I had one stroke, or maybe a couple of strokes of good luck, and I've at least maintained the place that those strokes of good luck put me.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten the next stroke of good luck to put me on the next tier level.
Does that just drive you nuts? Because, I mean, this is, you know, this is something that I've been wrestling with for a while now. It's like, you know, gotten to the point to where I've even, you know, questioned whether or not I should have even been doing this, you know. And again, I think it has to do with, you know, the birth of my son, the reevaluation of sort of like the decisions that I've made. You know, my wife would say, and she's correct, that you can never regret any decision that you've ever made because it got you exactly to where you are at this point.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
You know, and that's great, you know, and I understand that, but at, you know, there's something about me that I can't help but reevaluate, at least in the career aspect of it.
It sounds like a jet plane.
Yeah, is that actually maybe coming from Van Nuys Airport?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
What do they do?
The flight path is right over here.
I was just wondering what kind of planes do they have?
Well, it's mostly small planes, but you get like occasionally if you live near the Van Nuys Airport, and I'm surprised you haven't noticed that, given this is your podcast. And this is where you work all the time, but
See, this is why I'm not an actor.
Living very close to this area.
I forget where I am. I don't know. I can't keep my spot, right?
Well, it's
I'm missing my marks completely.
It's not that easy to behave realistically in imaginary circumstances. Yeah. It's not that easy. But anyway, this airport is mostly small planes, like Cessnas and hobbyist planes. But there are jets that land here, you know, puddle hoppers that go from like Burbank over to here or wherever.
So, you know, do you ever have that, you know, getting back to the point of you know, reevaluating your career, you know, because I think we can safely say that, you know, speaking for myself, you know, I'm completely unsatisfied of what I thought, you know, would happen or how easy it would be.
Did this other podcast. I can't remember what it was called, like Kibitz with Hicks or something like that. And he's really weird. He likes to do his interviews in the middle of the night after his guest is like had way too much whiskey.
Oh, you know what? That's probably a good strategy.
It's an interesting strategy. I think it kind of backfired on him because I stopped making sense. Yeah, and there was truth, but then I couldn't formulate certain
thoughts.
Hypotheses about the truths. But one of the things he asked me very pointedly is, you know, are you happy with how things turned out? Like he referenced a movie called Greenberg with Ben Stiller, which I haven't seen, but one of the questions that one of the characters asks is, you know, one of the hardest things in life is sort of figuring out or making peace or contending with the way things turn out.
Yeah.
You know, and he was asking me, you know, how are you and with the way things have turned out, pointedly meaning my career. And I just sort of said, well, if I'm going to be 100% honest, I would say I'm pretty miserable about how those things turned out.
Yeah.
You know, and I wrote a book about acting, which is, you know, it's sarcastic and but it's honest, you know, and here's the frustration you go through. But at the end of the book, just like your wife said, I said, but if I hadn't, chase these dreams, there'd be, I wouldn't have the wife that I have. I wouldn't have the kid that I have. Yeah, I wouldn't have the friends that I have.
Exactly.
And there, that, all that stuff is great. And that, you know, that's the positive, but it's impossible not to also contend with the negative.
I chalk it up to Catholic guilt.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I mean. I think you grew up Catholic, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, me too. Then, yeah. But non-practicing. No.
Yeah. No. I don't consider myself a Catholic at all anymore.
Well, neither do I.
But the ingrained Catholic guilt. But
yeah, the stuff there, you know, the stuff that, the baggage that it saddles you with, I think is still kind of there. So it makes you feel like, it makes me feel like, I can't put words in your mouth, makes me feel like I'm prone to introspection and also, you know, I can flay myself quite readily, you know.
Yeah, I do. Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I absolutely do, and you know, I go back and forth too between blaming the world at large, the corporate infrastructure of the world.
That's interesting. I don't do that,
and I do all that, and
I make
then
it all my fault.
I do that too. I mean, that's. It's like I go back and forth. That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's like some days I'm like, what am I talking about? It's not the fault of corporate America. It's because of I didn't do this or I didn't do that. Yeah. But then, like, when I really break it down, I go, what is it? Outside of, you know, because I did stand up when I was in high school and college, you know, just dabbled in it. And if I had pursued that, that's the only thing I can think of. That I didn't do.
That you might have done.
That I might have done that would have done me good.
Uh-huh.
Outside of that, I can't think of anything more that I could do.
Yeah.
As a person, you know, I've never stopped creating. I've never stopped acting. I've, you know, never stopped writing. I've never stopped doing and trying to, you know, whatever technology is at. You know, whatever. I mean, it's like the problem is I don't have any rich bazillionaire relatives who can give me lots of money to make a fancy looking pilot or something.
Yeah.
You know, so all my stuff is strictly low rent. But with what I've been given, making the best of what's around sort of thing, there's not a lot that I can think of that I didn't do.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, yeah, no, I understand because that's kind of where I am in a lot of ways where I think about, I review, you know, it's like, okay, you're unhappy about where you are in your career, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me review my career, you know, so I go back and then I think about all the things and I realize that, you know, I've done everything right, I think. You know,
it's
because, you know, I said yes to so much free work, you know, in order to build relationships with other people.
Me too.
You know, and the hopes that at some point, okay, you know, you move on to bigger and better projects, you know, and pretty soon you find yourself just kind of working. But instead, it's like, well, okay, yeah, you do that free work. And it leads to more free work, you know?
Right.
And then you just keep on doing free work.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And then like, nobody ever really has, like, progressed up to that next level. Very few of the people that I've, you know, worked with have progressed up to that next level. So it's almost like the luck of the draw.
Well, right. I think there's so much in it. I mean, it's like that the paying your dues, and I think I wrote about this in my book actually, that when any time someone in the entertainment industry says, "No, I can't give you this job," really, you got to pay your dues.
Right.
Is just a way of getting you to leave the office. You know what I mean? So they don't have to hassle with you anymore, because that is the paying your dues thing is such a load. It's such a load in show business. That may be true in other professions.
Well, I'm sure it is. I mean,
you have to, before you can be a master mechanic, you have to tinker around with, you can pay those dues.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, you know, with any job, with experience, you get better.
Right.
But the thing is in show business is they won't give you the job.
And who's keeping score anyway?
Yeah, exactly. Right? And there's no, and the
we went to the dues department. And, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Yes, you've reached your quota of dues.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's like, well, I feel like maybe I've paid enough dues for me and probably like 8 or 9 other actors at this point.
Isn't it like, well, yeah, you haven't suffered enough?
Do you think Lautner has paid enough dues and that's why he's a movie star? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, even Tom Hanks, like, he did, you know, he had one TV show that didn't do that well, and then boom, all of a sudden he was an 80s icon. You know, and it's like, did he pay?
Are you talking about Bosom Buddies?
Yeah, yeah.
That did well, didn't it?
Well, it was just a few seasons. It's not like it was...
But you know what? They fell in love with him, you know?
Well, but yeah, I love Tom Hanks. I'm not trying to, like, trash Tom Hanks. Understood. I'm just saying, but he also, I heard him in an interview, and they said, you know, how is auditioning for you? And he's like, oh, I love auditioning. I didn't get any jobs early in my career without auditioning. And I'm like, yeah, but, I mean, how many years of auditioning did you put in versus what I put in?
Yes, right.
And why is it that I haven't paid enough dues because... You know, and I'm not...
You know why? Because the universe isn't fair.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like, there's no... That's just a... That's a line. That's a line people say. And it's this luck. It's like what Bryan Cranston says. I mean, in the end, it's like, it doesn't matter how good you are, how talented you are, how driven you are, and even how many hours you've put in. It's just, there's so much luck involved.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever really heard anybody... I mean, nobody's ever said to me, you know, well, you just need to pay your dues. I mean, that would be something that you'd say to a younger person, right? Because they haven't, you know, I don't know. There must
be. Well, yeah, all I'm saying is, yeah, they say that to a younger person. But what I'm saying is, when somebody says that to you, they're not saying it to you because you're green.
No.
They're saying it to you because they want you to leave the office.
Right, right. Because also, Hollywood also likes a phenom.
Right.
You know, they like that, you know. Ever since Orson Welles, right? You know,
right, right.
They like that person that came out. Well, he didn't come out of nowhere, but the boy genius, you know, the
right.
You know,
but also, I mean, like, what, you know, it's also subjective, and I mean, like, one of the things that I've never been able to figure out is, you know, the it factor. Like, someone arbitrarily decides someone's got it, and then their PR people make everybody believe that person's got it.
Yep.
But what is it? I mean,
ask Simon Cowell. I don't know. He would probably.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Simon Cowell. Well, that's music, so it's a little bit different. But I mean, Simon Cowell is to not to put too fine a point on it, is a raging cunt, and he's just powerful, and he gets to arbitrarily choose what he likes.
Yeah.
And because he's got a lot of money backing him up, then that becomes, you know, somebody who's got it.
Yeah.
But that's just an arbitrary decision on the part of a rich man. It's not. That's what I'm saying. I mean,
that's because there is no it factor.
It's nonsense. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But everybody buys into it.
Yeah.
They buy into it.
Yeah.
That what makes a star is something that's special, the star is born with. And that's not true. I mean, like Judy Garland was a beautiful singer and very talented, but I'm sure there were lots of other people who sounded just as good as she
was.
Oh,
sure. No,
just as talented. Yeah. It just happened for her. She won the lottery.
Yeah. That's I mean, you know, and you have people like Cuba Gooding Jr., right, who wins an Oscar, and then look at what he's done after that, right?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it's like he seemingly had an it factor. Everybody loved him.
Right.
And then, you know, after
there was some serious backlash.
It can go the other way.
Yeah, he was the victim of serious backlash, though. It's sort of like if your performance isn't as, you know, if there are any, you know, chinks in the armor at all, you know, because, I mean, his performance in that movie is good, you know, but it's also, you know, it's the movie itself, I don't think, is great. I think it's an okay kind of, you know, formulaic, sticky sweet movie, and if you get revered for that, then there are going to be people... there's going to be backlash to that.
I mean, I liked that. I liked it. And I liked his performance. I wasn't sure about an Oscar, you know.
But that's the thing.
But at the same time, I can't say that, you know, whatever backlash that there might have been, I attribute that to more of his own. He decided, you know what, this is the time to cash in and do as many projects as possible. You know
well,
what I mean?
I think that's true about everybody, though.
Or do you think he just wasn't, you know, didn't get the right kinds of projects?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, there's also so much stuff that I don't know about Cuba. Maybe the guy's a jerk. And everybody he worked with. I mean, if you're enough of a jerk and you can't, like, open the movie to the degree that, like, a De Niro can, which Cuba never could, open a movie to that degree, you can't get away with being a prick for very long.
Yeah.
Eventually, people are going to go, we don't need him that much. You know, yeah. He charges a lot. He comes. He's, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not saying that's true.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
Who knows? We don't know him at all. So.
but it's like Jason Bateman. It's like at this point, it's like if a month goes by where a Jason Bateman movie doesn't open, I genuinely wonder if he's been killed or something. You know, I mean, and I think if you're hot, especially now, especially the way the corporate infrastructure works, and just show business is always like you're in favor and you're out of favor. So if you're in favor, maybe you should just take every job that comes down the pike and cash in. And the fact that, I mean, and that's Kurt Russell. Actually, Kurt Russell, he was talking to somebody like Will Ferrell or somebody weird like that who was saying, you know, was just starting to get stardom and getting all these offers. And he said, I don't know which one of these to do. And Kurt Russell was like, do all of them. Do all of them. Don't stop working. Just do everything. And the fact is the ones that work, people will remember.
That's right.
And the ones that don't, as long as you have ones that are working at the same time, they're going to forget the ones that don't.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, with Cuba is all of his choices from Judgment Night to Snow Dogs were really bad. I mean, he wasn't getting any good ones.
You have to have some good ones in order for that Kurt Russell theory to work out.
Right.
Because it's assuming. All I can say is about Kurt Russell, the only thing I really remember about him, there's plenty, you know, but the one thing that sticks out in my mind is The World's Strongest Man.
Kurt Russell?
Yeah.
How was he the world's strongest man?
That was the world's strongest teenager man.
The Disney one.
The image of the guy who's trying to lift the weights and his arms stretch out. I don't know. That I saw that when I was a kid, and that is always like stuck with
he
me.
He was in so many of those movies with monkeys and stuff.
Well, he was the Disney go-to boy, you know.
Yeah.
But there's, I mean, that's neither here nor there.
No. But I mean, I think I attribute it to his longevity to that very thing. I mean, he's just like, if they're giving you money to act, you should just take it.
So
if you can, I mean, if chances are, if you're a star, you can just keep stacking them up I'm going to do this one, not this one. You just go, I'm going to do this one. This is my priority. So you guys go first. I really want this, but I already said I would do this. So is there any way we can do this later? And chances are, if they really want you, they will wait 3 months to start their project.
So considering, you know, how we both agree that we're not exactly where we'd like to be with our careers.
Correct.
Okay. Does it make you bitter?
I have days, I have days where I'm really bitter, and it's also a function of age.
How do you deal with that? You know, I mean, because, you know, do you just say, well, I mean, am I going to just keep chugging at it? And like, or, you know, how do you deal with the...
I'll go in like a 2 week just bender. Until I just feel too sick to move, I'll recuperate and then go, okay, let me stop being a jerk. Because I find that if I hurt myself enough physically, then I can go, oh, maybe this is my fault while I'm not getting a job. Yeah. And then I get myself together again. And then I go out and still don't get a job and realize, oh, it didn't matter either way. Which is, that's when I get frustrated.
Yeah.
You know, and how do I deal with it? I it's like anything. It's like when my kid was born, 2 months early, I didn't want that. That was incredibly stressful and terrifying. People ask me how I dealt with it. And the fact is I just did. I dealt with it.
But that's something that I mean, I understand that.
Because, that's an event.
Well, that's an event. And I think actually the human, you know, the mind is very, very good at dealing with whatever is put in front of it at the moment.
That's true.
What the mind is not very good at is dealing with things that happen in the past or could happen in the future, because there's no control of that anymore. So you got like, you know, I mean, do you ever have like these weird past resentments? Like you just resent something that happened in the past and you just catch yourself going, you know, shit. You know, like, or saying something that happened so far in the past that you go, you know, where did that come from? And why am I still angry at that?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this has come up in other interviews I've done on all the podcasts that I do interviews on. And I'm actually really, I'm nipping at the heels of Patton Oswalt as far as being on the most guest stars on our very special guests on
yeah,
podcasts.
I hear he's pretty very prolific, actually.
Very close to Patton Oswalt at this point. One of the things that came up was, you know, and I still am very angry at the CW, or not the CW, but the I can't remember. It's whoever the network executive was. It was UPN and the WB. It was the WB, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm still kind of angry at that network that doesn't exist anymore, and I'm also really angry at Dan Cortez for taking the part that I, you know, I was perfect for. And if they had cast it the way they were going to cast it originally, with me and a few other lesser known actors, it would have been a successful show.
What was this?
It was a pilot. I had a network test for a pilot, and I went in, and I mean, and that's a nerve wracking thing, the network test. But I went in and it just killed. I mean, I killed. I've every word out of my mouth. I mean, I could barely speak.
Right.
And in fact, there were moments where I didn't, and I was just looking around. You know,
and killed,
and people were just dying laughing.
Wow!
I mean, and these are network executives.
That must be like the most.
They're not famous for like gales of laughter,
right?
You know,
that must be what it's like for a comedian when they're out there, like, you know, just you can't say anything bad.
That's great, yeah. And I've gotten there with audiences before, in theaters and clubs and stuff.
Right.
But that is not as foreign, at least for me, as in a room with executives.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Because I think executives are more relaxed and likely to laugh at somebody who they know and are familiar with and is a celebrity.
Right.
I actually had a test for Arrested Development, part of Job that what's-his-face wound up doing, Will Arnett. And I'm not saying that, you know, he was better for the part for me, certainly. But he wasn't even at the test that day. It was me and French Stewart. And French Stewart went in before me and just killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there it's like, I was like, wow, that's a warm room. But then as soon as I walked through the door, I was like,
crickets.
Oh, shit. No, it was before I even started auditioning. I could tell, like, you know, there's just sort of an audible sitting back in the chair, slumping in the chair. You know, immediately.
All right, show me something.
Yeah.
I'm already prepared to like you.
We just had a famous person here. Who are you?
Yeah.
You know, and it was like that. It's like, well, you know, we're happy because everybody gets happy around famous people for some reason.
Yeah, it's true.
But I don't have that going for me. Yeah. So then
you want the fame to rub off on you somehow. Right. You know?
Right. And so they're sort of in a position of, well, prove yourself. And it's like, I mean, the most I can do is what I do. And then, you know, it was so painful because as soon as I went into it, you know, there was no reaction whatsoever. And I was doing, it was funny too, because I'd done it for the producers and everybody.
Yeah.
And one of the producers at the producer session that I went to said, nobody who's read for this so far has nailed every beat of what, you know, we wrote like you just did. And I went in and they were there. You know, and I was doing the exact same thing, at least at the beginning, and I wasn't getting reaction from them or anybody else. So that was a painful bombing thing. But then this other thing was exactly the opposite. This other show, I went in and I couldn't, you know, without even trying.
Yeah.
You know, and they were just dying.
And you didn't get it.
And I didn't get it. They gave it to Dan Cortez.
And you still have the sort of like this resentment, like it's hard to let go.
It is hard to let go.
Even right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about even like, you know, stuff that is weird, like stuff that happened in my childhood. Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, ever go back that far? You know, where it's like
I had a guy.
Like, I'm still mad at somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Who, like would be he was my best friend until one day he decided that he wasn't going to be my best friend anymore.
Right.
And like, you know, dumped me in a very cruel way. Yeah. And then, you know, you get a Facebook invite from this guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I did it. And then I found out that he was like a completely super conservative, Obama hating, you know, you know, like just completely right wing.
The opposite of you. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel like, you know, yes, I'm more on the liberal side, but I feel like I'm pretty moderate. I'm actually registered as an independent.
Yeah.
But whenever I just hear crazy talk, you know, that just turns me off. And then I unfriended him because I was like, you know, I didn't even want to become your friend on Facebook anyway, because you dumped our friendship so long ago. And I hold on to these resentments, you know, still. Yeah.
I had the high school bully used to, you know, torment me my first couple years of high school. Last year, did the same thing. He friended me on Facebook. And
what do you do with that? You know,
I just ignore request. Screw you. You're a jerk to me. You're a jerk, and you're probably still a jerk. You're, you know, and it's like we have mutual friends who are like, well, you know, he's not that bad. I was like, well, no, yeah, he is. I mean, you don't just friend. If there had been a long letter of apology,
right?
You know, saying, I know he's such a jerk.
As if you're supposed to forget everything that happened.
Yeah, I'm never going to forget that. And you know, the fact is even a letter of apology, it's like, I will accept your apology, dude.
Yeah.
But I am never going to be your friend, because the stuff that you did to me, like, left a mark. It left an emotional mark.
And it's interesting because I do find that with, you know, MySpace and, you know, well, first MySpace, they're gone pretty much now.
Yeah.
You know, Friendster before that. It's like when this whole concept of what a friend is, you know?
Right, right.
Now to Facebook, where it's like, you know, now, well, a friend is anybody that can hit you up and say you want to attach your profile to mine. But it's still, you know, people have lost the idea of what a friend is, I think.
That's true. Because, well, to be honest, at this point, like, especially after that bully friended me on Facebook, I don't care who friends me on Facebook.
Yeah.
I say yes.
Yeah.
And I hope he's checking so he sees that I friend everyone.
See, I friend, and I friend, you know, I friend pretty much everyone too, because I don't live my life on Facebook like some people.
I don't either, Henry.
You know, so it just sits there inert most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, I did suddenly, you know, get this. At some point, you know, somebody from your high school links in with you, and then pretty soon everybody from your high school that you barely even knew.
Is
suddenly, you know, trying to be, you know, your friend. And I'm like, it's just the most weird feeling, because I barely hung out with any of these people.
Well, I think there's a little, like, with that, because, like, I honestly tweet a lot more. I mean, I never really Facebook very much. I just, like, if I'm doing something, a podcast or whatever, I'll say, I'm on a podcast.
Right.
Use it as a tool Facebook, in order that's to get it, to let people know publicity. That I'm doing this. Yes,
right.
That's it.
Right.
With Twitter more, because Twitter is kind of a jokey thing, like, a lot of people actually just post, you know, just had some coffee.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Why? Why? Who cares?
I personally don't understand Twitter at all.
But the joke, well, I do, because I'm not saying I do. I mean,
I barely understand Facebook.
The thing that's fun, at least with the people that I follow and follow me, for the most part, is that people are tweeting jokes. For the most part.
Right. Here's a little one-liner that you can only say within, like, 100.
Yeah. And a lot of it is, you know, I guess, alternative in its flavor, you know? It's not, anti-establishment. It's irreverent. That's the word I'm looking for.
Do you think that this is... In a way, this is kind of like fame, you know, or the quest for fame. Do you think the reason why that these sites are popular is because everybody wants to be famous? You know, I mean, because
Everybody wants to be loved by strangers.
Because
yes.
I've never
until the strangers try to make love to them. Yes, everybody likes it.
Because I've never quite understood the whole, I've never done Twitter because I don't know, honestly. Except for my wife, who would care what I was thinking about anything at any particular moment?
Well, I think, I mean, at least on Twitter, there's a sense of humor, like a in subject matter, and like people find each other somehow through their own various sensibilities. I mean, I think there is, it's weird because it's disconnected.
Uh-huh.
And people are essentially strangers, but you do connect with people according to their sense of humor or their kind of interest level or their whatever, their political activism or whatever. And then actually the world can feel, you know, less lonely, you know, when things are bad. You know, if you tweet, you know, I'll tweet some pretty sardonic, dark things sometimes. And then I find, like, a lot of people find the humor in that. And then I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not the only dude who's going through this stuff right now. Right.
Well, what would be the one tweet that you tweeted? Tweet? I don't know.
Tweeted, I guess. Yeah, Twittered.
Yeah. that got the most reaction.
I'm not sure. Actually, the baseball cap I'm wearing right now is
it, love me it, anyway.
Yeah. I just tweeted that one time, and that got retweeted by like I think 12 people, and that was such a great validation for me.
Yeah.
That I put it on a hat.
That's nice.
It's nice. It sounds sad, but it's actually really nice.
What does it mean?
I don't know. I was just like sort of. I can't remember. I was like somebody.
Where does a statement like that come from?
I think I was being argumentative with somebody, just to be argumentative.
Yeah.
And then I just thought to myself, they should love me anyway. Who cares if I'm a dick?
That would have been a good response to have, a good phrase to have in your hip pocket when you're younger.
Yeah.
And angrier.
Yeah.
Like gotten a lot more fights.
Yeah. And you should love me anyway.
You know what? Yeah. You know what? Just love me anyway.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
And where was I going with that?
I don't know. I do have another appointment I have to get to. I don't know how long your show runs usually. How long is your show usually?
You know what? You tell me. How long should it be?
Well, I think most podcasts are usually around an hour.
Because you're so fascinating, I could just keep talking forever.
I hear you. I could just listen to myself talk forever as well.
Do you do that?
Yeah.
Does that drive your life crazy?
I sleep, I talk. I talk while I sleep. It helps me relax.
Actually, I do that too.
You talk in your sleep?
I do.
Are they long monologues?
Usually it's something like, the cat, you know, and then I wake up startled.
Yeah. No, for me, it's just long monologues that go on all night.
Do you ever laugh in your sleep?
I don't know.
I laugh in my sleep.
I bet I have laughed in my sleep. Like, I'm sure I've done everything in my sleep.
Actually, belly laugh myself awake.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is exciting because it makes me feel like I might be actually well adjusted.
I think I'm more likely to wake up sobbing.
Yeah, see, I don't want that. You know, the laughing's better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true.
All right.
So, is there any more?
No. No,
you were about to ask me one more thing.
No, because it's
you can ask. You can go ahead. I don't have to leave just this second. It's soon because you know I'm busy. I have a lot of
I have a lot
of bit player stuff to do.
Yeah, it's getting dark out.
It is. It's dark.
It's getting really dark in here right now.
It is dark.
It started off very light,
and now it's dark.
And now it's incredibly.
Yeah, it's strange how you run your sessions, but that's kind of nice.
Yeah, no, it gets more intimate. See, that's the thing. As the sun sets.
It does get more intimate, yeah.
It does.
That's nice.
It does. So what? Tell me just real quick, in like you know a couple sentences, why did you become an actor? That's so unfair, isn't it?
In two sentences. Well, the long and the short of it is, when I was a kid, I was, as most people who grow up in American towns are, their schools are sports centric. There was a lot of soccer at my school, and there was a lot of basketball, and then there was football, even though you know it wasn't the most popular sport at my school, and baseball, of course. And I tried them all except for football. I mean, I played tag football and stuff, but never actual on an actual team. And I was no good at any of it. And then one of my teachers in junior high suggested, you know, I try out for the play.
Were you a class clown?
That she was directing. No, I was very quiet.
Yeah.
I didn't become a class clown until after I started acting. And then in high school, I was more of a Weisenheimer. But before that, I was pretty quiet. But anyway, so I sucked at sports. And a teacher said, well, maybe you should try, you know, this acting, because, you know, she liked me. And she said, oh, you should try this. So I tried it, and people liked me doing it. So I said, oh, okay, so this is something I'm good at. And all the people who think I suck at sports watched me and said, wow, that was great. So I should just keep doing this. And also, you know, attention from the opposite sex happened as a result of being good at something. So, you know, I was accepted as an actor,
yeah.
And women or not women, but girls at the time thought, hey, you know, maybe he's not a completely useless waste of space. And that's why, you know, yeah. and that rose into the delusion that, well, if they want me to do it, of course, who everybody else will as well.
Yeah, because you know why? This is easy.
This is easy.
Yeah. Well, it was really good talking to you. Well,
thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, and there's just like a million things that we could talk. We didn't even really scratch the surface on the whole Catholic thing. That could be its own show altogether.
That's true.
You know, and it may or may not even require your participation.
You could just talk about Catholicism.
I could, because I did. Yeah, well, last night I did it with my wife, and you know, a little bit, and belief and all that. And
yeah.
It just got into this weird area where we had to go to sleep.
It's a lot of times when I talk Catholicism with my wife, it gets into a weird area where she needs to go to sleep.
Yeah,
it's weird. So, no matter what time of day.
No, yeah. So I think, okay, well. There you go. So I'm sure that we have nothing to talk about there, because it's exactly the same thing. It'd be like talking to a mirror. All right, Todd.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks.